We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy vanilla Visa gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank, MetaBank, and Sutton Bank, members FDIC, pursuant to a license from Visa USA, Inc., and may be used in the U.S. everywhere Visa debit cards are accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services. NMLS ID number 912772.
Welcome to the next episode of the Palisades Podcast. I'm Steve Crone.
And I'm Brooke Dougherty.
And today we have a very special guest. All I know is that our special guest's first name is Matt.
That's right.
And he works for the Palisadian Post.
That's right. We're flying blind.
Yeah. We met about 10 minutes ago, and we decided we'd try it a little different today. We're going to find out about Matt on our podcast, and so as you, our listeners, our many thousands, tens of hundreds of thousands of listeners are listening, you'll get to hear it just the same time we get to hear all about Matt.
Well, we thought we could use a little youth.
Yes. You can't see it, our loyal listeners, but Matt is
a good 5 years younger than
either of us.
That's
and
right.
Maybe 30, 40 years younger than our average guest age.
We won't need to get into
probably
specifics.
40 years younger than us.
Yeah.
How old are you?
I'm 23.
23.
Wow.
So in keeping with our pattern of interviewing icons and legends of the Palisades.
Yes, yes.
Right.
You are 5 years younger than
youngest of my three children. Maybe he's an icon in the works.
He's
an early icon.
And someday we'll look back on this and we'll say, we had Matt, what's his name? Matt something or other, back before he was
good.
Famous.
It's Matt Meyer.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And folks who read the Post probably know me as Matthew Meyer, but Matt to friends, which we already are in these brief 10 minutes.
Yes.
So yeah,
yes.
Feel free to call me Matt. But yeah, folks who read the Post are probably familiar with my byline. It's scattered throughout every week. So,
well, I'm not so sure, but they may be.
Now, you don't do you do education, but not sports.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, we have an incredible sports editor.
Who's your sports guy?
I thought we were having the sports guy in today. Now you tell me.
All right, I'm sorry to disappoint you. Well, this will be the shortest Palisades podcast. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, we have a fantastic sports editor who's been doing it for years, Steve.
Yeah.
And so he covers sports. That includes, obviously, all the school sports. I cover education from a policy perspective, but also just, goings on at the school. So anything, you know, as simple as a fundraiser that they're doing, you know, raising money for a good cause to I had the chance to cover kind of blow for blow this recent school board election, which ended up being the most expensive in the country and had some very significant implications for, you know, the future of education in LA.
So you know our friend Nick Melvoin.
I know our friend Nick Melvoin, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, that's right.
Great
and his
guy.
People.
And his people.
Yeah, Allison Holder of Pole Hill.
Mm-hmm.
She's from the Palisades, and I've worked with her as well. She works in his office now.
I understand you also, after having listened to our podcast with Jeff Lantos, looked into that as a possible story.
Yeah. I mean, I look into any story that comes across my desk. Certainly, if it involves education in the Palisades, I'm there. What's so fun about the Post is that's not the only thing I get to have my hand in. That's obviously the thing that I always have my fingers on the pulse of. But, I mean, I have covered such a wide variety of things in the Palisades. For a hyper-local publication to work for a hyper-local publication in the Palisades expands the number of things that you cover immensely, because the people here have so many fascinating stories to
tell. Cats caught up in a tree,
things like that.
Celebrity cats.
A new crosswalk painted into the street somewhere or other.
Sure.
Like that.
Yeah, well, all the day-to-day goings-ons, but also, as you folks know, there's a lot of movers and shakers here, a lot of fascinating people, and one of my favorite things to do is to profile folks who live in town and talk to them about the work that they've done. It's extraordinary, the range of fields that people work in, from philanthropy to business to entertainment.
And that was the inspiration, if you could call this inspiration. That was what inspired Brooke and I to start this podcast.
Absolutely.
We have an incredibly diverse and creative and dynamic community, and let's interview them and let people in the community find out more about their neighbors.
Steve, that's exactly right.
Do your thing that you usually do with everybody about, you know,
what?
That, like, tell us about your back.
You know, we're getting to that.
He's only got,
I don't think he's
years.
Interested. I don't think
Yeah, it's been 10 minutes, and I think I've run out of questions, Matt.
I haven't. I could spend an hour interviewing him.
We were going to do that, but we kind of got off track. But we're flexible. We can.
We're flying blind, like we said at the top. We're going to feel this thing out.
So, but my taskmaster over here, Brooke,
okay,
wants me to ask, so I will, about your background.
Oh, what an insightful,
how is that
fascinating
creative?
Question.
You can thank Brooke for that.
I'll ask him. So, where were you born?
I grew up in Upland, which is about an hour mm-hmm. east of here.
Claremont.
Kind of the foothills of Mount Baldy for the skiers and hikers. It's right in there.
And
it's beautiful this time of year.
It is, yeah.
Which is the only time of year.
Yeah, and then otherwise it's pretty dang hot.
Hot and humid and smoggy.
Yeah.
And your family?
Although
your mom?
Better these days, actually.
Yeah.
Mom, dad, siblings?
Yeah. Grew up mom and dad and one older sister. And I guess if you're asking, you know, kind of how I ended up doing this, I think...
Yeah, where did you go wrong? Looking back, where was the wrong turn? I didn't want to jump that fast.
So what'd your dad do? What does your mom do?
So my father's a pilot. My mom's a teacher of many years. She recently retired.
Public school?
Yeah, public school. Yeah.
Pilot for a commercial airline?
Yeah, commercial airline, yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, so that's certainly a lot of fun, those two. Both of them definitely brought things about, you know, who they are and what they do, because those two things for them are intertwined. They both love what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of them kind of brought elements of those things into the house.
And then what did you do in high school? Who were you in high school?
I was a reformed class clown, I guess would be the best way of putting it.
A reformed class clown?
I was the classic, it's such a tired trope, but for me it actually was true. It was if you could just take that energy of his and channel it into something productive instead of being a terror. And around high school was when that started to happen for me. So I got really into acting and comedy. And also into writing and storytelling. And those two things were intertwined, of course. Did you do drama class
and plays and stuff in high school?
Yeah, primarily theatrical comedy. So like a lot of stage comedy, a lot of improv and sketch comedy. And that ended up being something that I continued to do in college and that I continue to do today. So it's definitely a big part of my life.
And did you do writing, journalism, anything like that in high school?
Absolutely. So I was so fortunate. I can kind of, the signposts, if you will, of me becoming a writer are kind of marked by the people that I got exposed to in school. And those people encouraging me to pursue this. So I remember in eighth grade, Mr. Mooney, a history teacher, telling me that one of the things that I had written, I had a little bit of fun with it. I got kind of into the project, and I really kind of wrote it in a more exciting way than just a typical essay. And he kind of said, hey, you know, keep pushing for that. And then in high school, I had teachers who encouraged me. So by the time I was done with high school, I was pretty dead set on not just being a writer, but being a journalist specifically. So...
So how did you end up at UCSB?
Yeah, so I went to UC Santa Barbara. Actually, I almost didn't go, specifically because they didn't have a journalism major. That was a concern for me. Certainly, I had this idea that that was obviously a critical part of becoming a journalist, is you go to a school and you major in journalism. But
yeah,
again, these people, but these people that that I've mentioned, these people who have guided me, these mentors, particularly in writing, a senior year English teacher, I sat down with her and I told her, you know, I'm in love with UC Santa Barbara. It's where my older sister, who I referenced, where she went to school, and I had visited the campus and I loved everything about it, aside from their lack of journalism major. And I told her this, and she said, oh, just go. And I said, really? And she said, oh, just go. No one, as a writer, no one cares about your major as much as they do about your body of work. She said, go to the school that you want to go to, study something that's relevant, and create a body of work to be proud of. And so that was the path I ultimately followed. I went and I studied political science. And
how did you create a body of work?
I hit the ground running with the campus newspaper, that classic, perfect place many a good writer starts.
Sure.
And that was a great, the paper at UC Santa Barbara, shout out to the Daily Nexus, still read it from time to time. That was a great place to grow as a writer. And then a little bit later in school, I got involved in, at least interested in, TV journalism. On-air reporting and writing for broadcast, and I got a job at a part-time job. They were great to students at just this tiny little, not public access, but government access TV station in Santa Barbara.
Cool.
And I worked for them for 2 years and kind of learned the ropes of cutting, you know, broadcast segments.
So you learned how to be a journalism by working for the paper, and then you were doing this thing for the public access,
yeah,
and learn something about production and news shows.
Exactly. I was blown away by how much they let me do right away. I remember when I first got that job, I had been writing for the newspaper, and that was within my comfort zone because, you know, I'm writing among students, and mm-hmm. we held ourselves to a high standard.
Covering what, any campus related issues or?
So that's kind of funny. I primarily wrote opinion work in my first couple of years at the school, and I had this idea that my path in journalism was to imbue the world with my wisdom about current affairs and political events.
We're getting to that. We want to hear your wisdom, and we'll get to that in a few minutes.
Well, unfortunately, I won't have much that I'll dispense, because ultimately what I learned is that that's not a particularly interesting or novel way to approach journalism at all, especially today. Everyone has an opinion, and it's getting easy to put out, quote, hot takes online. And not spend a whole lot of time learning people's stories. And ultimately, it was actually the Access station where I realized covering even seemingly mundane things can be pretty fascinating, and you can actually add more of a sense of public understanding by, you know, covering the new bridge that is being put in by someone's house than you can by mm-hmm. spouting a political opinion that's been repeated a bunch of times.
Talking about grandiose things, Brooke and I have both been avid followers of the Axe Files with David Axelrod.
Okay.
And he was a journalist, and he talks about, you know, he ended up working in the White House for President Obama and helped run his campaign, but he also talks about being a journalist and being down in the weeds, right at the basic level, covering local politics, covering, you know, whether there's a pothole that hasn't been covered, things like that. He said he really got to learn how city government worked, and that helped him in the rest of his career, helped him, you know, when he was working in the White House, not in as a journalist. And he said it just, you know, getting down there and really seeing how things work on the basic level is really critical to everything.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's, of course, room in the journalism space for opinion writing and for people to imbue grand ideas about the way things ought to be, but folks like him might be better suited to do that, and folks like me might really benefit for doing exactly what you say, getting in the weeds and finding out what's happening in people's communities.
At least for now.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, you could be the next David Axelrod. We certainly won't be, but you could be as you grow older.
So, not to change the subject.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. So,
feel free. I think I probably drifted this far, far.
No, it doesn't matter.
Away
so, Upland
we
started
all
anyway.
On.
Upland.
Yes.
Different school district than LAUSD. Yeah.
That's correct. Yep.
How would you compare your high school in Upland to Pali High?
You know what? That's a really interesting question.
That's a good question. I'm proud of you.
I was so fortunate. I went to a fantastic, large public school. So in a lot of ways, a lot like Pali.
Upland High School?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Upland High School. Large school. And and not a charter. So I would obviously that's a difference, although I don't know how much attention I would have been paying to how my school was governed when I was in it. But sure. But interesting to me now that I've moved to the Palisades, where so many schools are charter schools. But aside from that difference in the way that it's run, at least in terms of the programs that are offered, I would say they're actually really comparable. And that's me giving props to my alma mater, which I certainly didn't have that much affection for when I was there. But as I've learned more about, you know, the quality of education and how wildly it can vary.
Were the programs that the resources at Upland, were most of those provided by the district, or were most of those provided by fundraising from by parents?
Oh, that's a good question, and I can't pretend to speak with a vast amount of authority on how, you know, how that broke down at Upland, just because, again, when I was there, I was 16 and I was worried about girls and the dance, but and other things. But I will say that certainly Pali has an immense amount of that. I can only imagine that there are more student and, or I should say parent and community funded programs at Pali, or at least supported, or maybe half and half between the school and the parents than at Upland. But yeah, I can't pretend to know for certain how exactly Upland broke down that way.
One of the things that we talked to Nick about was how do you go about taking this immense fundraising capacity that you have in affluent communities like the Palisades and spread it out among schools that don't have those kinds of parents that are able to contribute like that?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a lot of ways that becomes a public policy question, because the reality is, and it's not a bad inclination, I mean, of course we want to take care of our own, and of course it's easier to fundraise for our child's schools, sure, our child's programs. So that I think that does become a public policy question for people like Nick. I think that that's a question, and the people who vote people like Nick into office, whether they think that there should be public policy that diverts funds to schools that are in need, but also how we define schools that are in need.
And how do you get people in a wealthy community like ours to say, we're going to go through the time and the effort to put on a fundraiser and know that a substantial portion of the money they raise will never be spent on their kids?
Sure, and assure them that those funds will be used properly.
Right.
Assure them that those funds, when they do, not only not go to their kids, but how are these specifically being used? I mean, it's tricky. It's tricky, and it's a public policy question. Again, we're talking about how starting at this kind of lowest level, the community level, the individual school, you can see how quickly you can zoom out and extrapolate these problems to larger things.
The location that you cover, so there's Village School, there's mm-hmm. Seven Arrows, there's Pali Elementary, and mm-hmm. they're all in a triangle,
mm-hmm.
right? So two of those schools, the children are customers. They pay their money, or their family pays their money, and the school provides what the kids need. And the public school, the school provides what it provides, and the other things that the families feel aren't there, they fundraise for. So it, in a way, kind of turns the public school into a de facto private school.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating how many distinctions there are now, too, between charter schools, traditional schools, affiliated charter schools. There are all these different models, and I think everybody, I will say, this is kind of a kumbaya message, but I do mean it. Everybody that I encounter at each of these different models, everyone thinks and wants to believe and continues to pursue the best thing for their kids. And it's just, you know, again, it's public policy questions, and it's also conversations that parents need to have in terms of what kind of schools they want to send their kids to. And I'm fascinated to just observe it all and just to absorb it.
And as a parent who has three kids, and they pretty much equally divided their upper education. They all went to Marquez, but their upper education was equally divided between public and private schools through middle school and high school. And my impression all along was the people in private schools said, this is the best way to go. How could you send your other kid to public school? And the people in public schools say, you're wasting your money by sending them. We have all these fundraisers. We supplement the school. It's the public school is better than private school.
Well, public, and they're all public school can absolutely be equal to private school in an area where you can achieve the same resources. But
there's a public school parent speaking.
No, I'm not a public school. My daughter went to Marquez and then she went to Archer. But I think the difference is that when you go to private school, you write a check. And everything that you need for that kid is provided. And at the end of the year, they say, here's your kid. And she or he has taken drama and dance and art and ceramics and AP this and that, and you're done. And it's pretty clean and straightforward. But in public school, if you go to public school X that doesn't have wealthy parents, you're not going to get all the drama and ceramics and swimming and all of those things. You're going to get the very, very basics of what happens between 7:30 in the morning and 2 in the afternoon, but not the things that we all know really make a kid a well-rounded college likely child. So I once sat down with the head of business at Archer and asked, how much does it really cost to educate a girl if you back out the real estate? You know, if you just keep it apples to apples with public school. And it's really, private school isn't really all that expensive to give a kid everything that he or she needs. I mean, I just think it would be nice if all the public schools sort of had the same amount of after school resource money. Well, that's just my
thing. That'd be nice, thing. But it doesn't seem to be the way it is. And parents have to, in public schools, they have to get more involved. You know, they have to try and figure out who the best teachers are in the elementary school. So you get your kid in the class you want. You fundraise so they get arts and music. And
But most of the schools, I mean, aside from the little bubble that we live in on the west side and a few other bubbles around town, most schools are never going to have the parent resources to hire a librarian, hire an art teacher, hire have a sports program to hire an extra football coach. They don't have it. And I think as long as individual public schools are allowed to fundraise just for their school, that it doesn't really count as public school.
Yeah, I mean, these are the questions, these are the opinions, these are the problems. I mean, yeah, absolutely. The discussion that you just had is a discussion that I see play out between parents, between administrators, at the debates for that school board election, which was fascinating. There are no easy answers. And again, I think that what I've learned is my role in this, or at least what I perceive to be my role in this, is to not opine like we were talking mm-hmm. about, but to listen. Because I mean, and we talked about, I'm still young and I don't have children of my own. So again, my role has always been to listen and to write what I find and to do it as accurately, as fairly as possible. And to let these to be a conduit for these conversations. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of the time I've learned that I am most helpful as a listener. I think that's something that was a shift that I had, the shift that we were talking about midway through my college career. I learned that I'm going to be a lot more help, as a lot of my role is going to be listening and learning and then trying to accurately portray these stories and these conversations.
Unless you're hell-bent on conveying fake news.
Sure, which I'm not a peddler of.
Okay, well, you know, so you say. I mean, nobody admits to peddling fake
news. So what is your, what goes on your Tuesday editorial meetings at the paper? And then
I thought we were going to get into how he got to be a journalist.
We did. We know how he got to be a journalist.
We go back? So you go to college, you're working for the school newspaper, and you're working for the Access Station.
Yeah.
How did that, you know, where'd you go from there?
Yeah, so I got done with school in 2016.
You're so young. Mira
College
Bay.
In 2016?
Yes.
You're still
I'm sorry.
Wet behind
He's
the
still
ears.
Drying.
It's appalling. Jeez. I know. It's appalling.
My
it's
God.
Disgusting. Well, read my work and decide if it...
I read it religiously.
Decide if it reads that way.
Yeah.
So I got done with school, and I had this fantastic reel of work, of my on-air reporting, of my segments that I had written and edited. So I had that going. I also had a nice portfolio of written work. I did what my senior year AP English teacher told me to do. I created a body of work. And so then you go shopping that body of work and you get slapped in the face by the reality that there are a lot of people who have great bodies of work who are still having a hard time finding work in this industry. And I applied to... I got done with school and I spent that whole summer. I went back home to Upland. It was very hot, as you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
And I spent a lot of time applying to schools. I knew that I wanted to be in Los Angeles because this
applying
is...
Applying to schools?
I'm sorry, applying to jobs. Thank you. Good catch. applying to jobs all over the place. I had an idea that I wanted to be in Los Angeles. And I mean, I remember I got so close to so many different roles. One I was so excited about, I was going to write list articles, 10 things you didn't know about blank, for a history website. And that was the most exciting lead I had for a month. Hmm. And I got turned down from it. It's hard. There are a lot of places that will ask you to write for free. And that wasn't something that I could do, obviously.
Right.
And then I had a friend of a friend's fiance, had a situation where they knew a reporter at the Pali Post who was going to be leaving their position. They said, hey, you should get your portfolio and your resume over to them and see if you can get an interview. I got an interview. I sat with John and Sarah, my editors, today. And we hit it off. We chatted for, I'm sure it was, it felt like an eternity because you're in the hot seat. It wasn't terribly long. But I felt really good walking out of there. And I thought to myself, this is a heck of a lot better than writing listicles. I'll be a reporter. I'll have a beat. I will develop sources and I will have a body of work that I can be proud of.
And you'll be in one of the most influential communities in the country.
No kidding. And you were teasing me, about what do you cover? Cats and trees, crosswalks. I cover my share of cats and trees and crosswalks, but I also report from an epicenter of Los Angeles, influence. And the people who live here and telling their stories, but also the stories of their kids and the future of their education, for example, which is, of course, the beat that I grew into. It has exceeded my wildest dreams. And I'm not just saying this because John's going to listen to it later, I'm sure. I mean, I really, the opportunities to meet people and to report on these people's lives and their life's work, it's a heck of a lot better than writing listicles in a cafe for 8 hours a
day. How did you get into the education beat? There's nothing about your background that... where you were always interested in education.
Well, his mom was a teacher, for
my,
one thing.
Okay, but... So my mom was a teacher, and I studied political science, so I had some public policy background, and I had that background with my mom. But certainly, no, I was not selling myself as an education writer. But the way it often goes, I had been writing freelance. I made the job search sound a little dramatic. I did have some freelance work, so it wasn't like I was scraping by with absolutely nothing. But I had been doing some freelance work, and I had been writing for a political website, and I had just done an extensive piece, like a 2,400 word long form on charter schools and the debate surrounding charter schools. And that was one of my pieces of work that came across, Sarah and John's desk when they were considering
me.
And John says, beats find you. And that beat found me. They said, okay, so you write about education. I said, yeah,
so
I write about education.
You covered the whole school board thing.
I did, yeah. Yeah, the,
wow.
The Melvoin-Zimmer race from start to finish.
The Battle of the Lawn Signs.
The Battle of the Lawn Signs, the Battle of the Mailers, the Battle of the Never-Ending
Debates.
The Mailers were intense. It was an intense race.
You couldn't tell, the Mailers got so convoluted.
As they always do, yeah.
Right. But
it became the most expensive school board race in U.S. history.
And now what's going to happen? Isn't there a big brouhaha about
There is a brouhaha. With the board president right now, Ref Rodriguez.
A sexual improprieties thing.
No, not a sexual improprieties thing.
Oh, nice try. Careful. That was good.
That was a good guess, wasn't it?
No. The handling of campaign funds and some conflict of interest claims
about how a whole bunch of money is.
You cover that too, even though that's not Palisades education?
So it always just depends. You know, we cover the Palisades specifically, and if someone's not from the Palisades, if something they're doing isn't directly affecting the Palisades, I can't generally sell a story on it yet. But what I'm always looking for is that that Palisadian angle, because there always is a Palisadian angle. Things in Los Angeles that happen as a whole, they come back to the Palisades. They affect the Palisades in one way or another, and certainly that's the case for LAUSD. So it's not something that I'm covering on a regular basis. It's absolutely something that I'm reading all of the coverage of from multiple, you know, sources, and I'm waiting for that time when it affects something that Nick is doing, or when it affects something that's happening in our schools, and when that time comes, I absolutely want to let folks in the Palisades know specifically how this affects us here.
So it would that be like something that you'd look forward to, something that you kind of come upon it while covering something in the Palisades, and it turns out it's a much bigger issue that you can run with it, and
that happens
into a big thing that affects the city.
That happens all the time. So many of the things, again, not just because of the people who live here, but also because the Palisades is part of Los Angeles as a whole. As much as it is its own separate bubble,
right?
This is Los Angeles.
Yeah, we are LA County.
That's right, and so we're LA City.
Right.
And so things that happen in LA City come back through the Palisades, and vice versa. And so, absolutely, sometimes stories, I go from an email from someone that I think, okay, I'll look into that, to a story that I spend months on. It happens.
So what do you think is the state of education in the Palisades? What do you think are the big hot button issues?
Charter schools. Charter schools have to be the hot button issue. And it's kind of a tired issue.
Do we have any schools that aren't charter schools in the Palisades?
There are charter schools and private schools.
Oh, private schools, right.
Yeah, yeah. I'm trying to think. There are so many schools here. I feel like I'm going to somehow forget somebody. I can't think of a non-charter immediately off the top of
there
my
isn't.
Head.
There isn't.
They call it the Palisades Charter Complex.
Right.
Charter schools were the hot button issue in that school board election that we've talked about, and they're the hot button issue in education across the country. Like I said, I mean, when I got this job, I had just finished up a big old piece about charter schools that was a nationwide conversation. So I think that definitely, like we talked about, these thorny issues of how do we raise money for schools? Where does that money go? How do we make sure that money is being used properly? And who is making all these decisions? That is the crucial question at the crux of this charter, private, traditional, affiliated, etc. debate. That's at the crux of this is who should have influence over what goes on at our schools. And so that absolutely, as much as the candidates repeatedly said this is not just an election about charters, and it absolutely wasn't. They both had a lot of ideas about other things, but the reality was they were both pretty similar. They're mm-hmm. both liberals. They had pretty similar outlooks on what education should look like. And like I said, again, it's my kumbaya line, but it's true. Everyone wanted what was best for the kids, and it was just a question of how do we get those services to them? How do we get those programs in our schools?
Well, I think the line is everybody wants what's best. Is it everybody wants what's best for the kids, or everybody wants what's best for their kids?
That's a fair question, yeah.
And that's...
And I think there's a lot of people who want both.
Yeah.
But, of course, self-interest is the name of the game.
Do you, at the Post, ever get involved in some of the bigger educational issues, like on the national level, like we changed from, was it Arne Duncan, who was the head of education under Obama, now to Betsy DeVos? Does that trickle down far enough that it will impact education here?
Absolutely. So Betsy DeVos, but again, this was another way in which Zimmer and Melvoin were really not terribly different people. Both of them were appalled by a lot of the policies and ideas coming out of a DeVos camp. So mm-hmm. again, you know, it's that idea of a lot of things trickle down to the Palisades, whether it's from LA City, LA County, California, or the entire country. Absolutely. And I always touch on those things. But I also keep in mind that, you know, I would like to think that the Post readership is pretty well read, and pretty well educated and pretty well informed. I think that they probably have read three takes on what Trump said today. And so I'm going to focus on either how what Trump said actually affects Pacific Palisades specifically, mm-hmm. or another issue that's affecting the Palisades specifically, because I know my lane.
Your local newsiness. Like if you said that for a long time the star calling card of Marquez was Jeff Lantos, right? That's what that school was known for. What would you say some of those other rock stars are at some of the different schools?
Oh, that's such a good question. And I feel like if I start calling people out by name, I'll miss a million people.
Yeah, okay. I'll sidestep
slightly because I'm a wily journalist and I don't want to get myself caught in a trap.
Or lose your job.
Job.
Let's reframe it.
I wouldn't lose my job for offending people, trust me. But
okay. What do you think some of the...
When you said rock star in Pali schools, I had to think of Pali High. The elementary schools do amazing a million things, and I'm not discounting the incredible things that they do or that Paul Revere does. In fact, I'll give a quick shout out to Paul Revere's farm, which is just the coolest thing. The fact that you have a farm on a school in Los Angeles, I mean, are you kidding me? That's incredible.
And not to forget Marie Stegmeist.
Absolutely.
Who's
the heart, and soul of that. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Yep. But I will say at Pali High, just because, you know, that's the largest, and a place that I spend a lot of time. I have to say personally, I'd like to think that I have a very friendly, but also very fair and objective relationship with the folks over at Pali who know me well at this point. I don't play favorites or do them favors by not covering certain things that I know they'd prefer I didn't cover. But also I have a lot of admiration for the work that they do over there and some of the programs that they have, some of the efforts that they make to keep up with the realities that we're facing, but also just to try to be proactive about students' mental health, students' physical health. I'm blown away. I just did a story about they have Westside family health clinics, mobile clinics, discreet places where kids can get advice on sexual health. They have programs, peer-to-peer counseling for kids who are feeling isolated. They just hired, I'm trying to remember the name of the exact position. Campus Unification Director. They just hired someone whose full-time job is to create programs and activities throughout the day that create a better sense of unity among a student body that has dealt with some pretty upsetting realities recently. They had two pretty damaging vandalism incidents in the last 2 years. One that used homophobic slurs, one that used racist slurs. And they don't, you know, they don't sit back and say, well, the kids will figure it out, or this is something for their parents to help them figure mm-hmm. out, which is, you know, parents absolutely have to play a role in helping their kids grapple with these issues, same as sexual health, same as any other. But they say, what resources can we provide on school, on campus, here at school?
Yeah.
And I think that's incredible, especially when you consider the wide range of regions that they serve. Kids who go to Pali live in 100 different zip codes mm-hmm. around Los Angeles.
Yeah, and it somehow works.
I'm coming off very raw here.
It's not by chance. You're saying it's designed.
It's not by chance. Exactly. And I'm happy to be raw. I mean, this is our school and we're this town's paper and they have flaws and challenges just like any other school, but I think they do a pretty incredible job over there.
So, since you mentioned it, and you have been rah-rah, and I appreciate that, what do you see the biggest flaws in the local public schools right now, other than limited resources, which goes hand in hand with public schools?
Exactly. It's so hard to separate these issues from, well, if they had more resources to address this problem. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of a specific because I don't want to just give you a generality, but it's so hard to pinpoint these specific things without pointing to a lack
of resources. I think one of them is that,
talk to me.
In the Palisades, the kids that take buses home after school sometimes aren't there for the programs that run later.
Sure.
Yeah. Which is a drag that we had when we were having real-time Young Angels meetings in the evening at 6 o'clock. A lot of the kids that that we would have liked to have been there, there's not like a late bus.
Yeah. You actually, transport. It's interesting that you would bring up transportation. I can speak, you know, at least generally about transportation at Pali High. They recently had to change their bus vendors. Mm-hmm. They have a huge geographical logistical challenge in
right.
getting a bus vendor to be willing to send as many buses as Pali needs, because it's not two or three from all these different areas, and get them all the way to the Palisades and get them all the way back, and then provide, like you're saying, maybe a later service. Transportation is a real challenge. How do we keep this geographical reach and keep these kids coming here when, again, money is always a real problem?
And it somehow works for the athletic departments.
What do you mean?
Well, the teams seem to be able to play away games and still somehow make it home.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know specifically about how that breaks down. I will say that, of course, you know, if you're busing one team, that's one bus, as opposed to all the buses that you need in the morning or all the buses that you need in the evening.
But anyway, that's just one thing that came to the top of my mind.
Yeah, transportation's a challenge. Again, like I said, this geographical reach that they enjoy, the reality of that is that getting all these kids here and getting all of them home safely, that's a real challenge.
So I'm curious about how a small town newspaper works. I think you guys have your meetings on Tuesdays to decide how things are assigned, because I know we had trouble getting a meeting set up with you on Tuesday.
The fact that I'm here on a Tuesday, I have to tell you, it's a small miracle. Tuesdays are crazy day, because we're a weekly, which is, I mean, it's a, generally speaking, it's pretty, I won't say easy, but it's manageable to get your schedule lined up in a way to where when Tuesday deadline rolls around, you have all or most of your stories filed before you even come in that day.
The paper gets delivered on Thursday.
The paper gets delivered on Thursdays. It goes to print on Wednesday after we finish up with it Tuesday night. Now, the challenge is every Tuesday, three things seem to happen in town. it seems like all the news,
bank robbery,
the most recent bank robbery was at 5 p.m. on a Tuesday. Without fail, folks, anything, if it's going to happen in the Palisades and we need to cover it, it's going to happen on Tuesday around 5 p.m. when we've just got the paper laid out.
So do you bring that into your digital, into your website before, and then cover it the next week, or how does that work?
We do our print product is still, you know, now I'm speaking like a company man. I can only speak from my personal, you know, view, but I think a lot of us still feel this way. Our print product is absolutely the crux of our product, what we offer. We're proud to still be a newspaper. And so we try to fit everything in as possible. You know, even if it happens at 5 p.m. on a Tuesday, well, we're going to move some things around and try to squeeze something in on this.
So
newspaper
with emphasis on the paper.
Absolutely. But I'm glad that you brought up the website element, because absolutely. Exactly. We have breaking news alerts via email, and we have a revamped website, and we have a pretty active Facebook page and an Instagram for that matter. But in terms of for news purposes, those breaking news alerts, those emails that go out to everybody just like that when we get them going, and the Facebook page and the website certainly help us when something happens on a Wednesday and that paper's already off to print. There's nothing we can do about it in print until the next week, but we can get something up on it right away.
So Tuesdays, you have your meeting, everybody's sitting around, and somebody, I assume it's John, makes a decision what's going to go in, what's not going in the paper?
Yeah, the beauty of it is the editorial team that we have has been working together for a while now.
It can't be that long. You only started a year ago.
When you're working on a paper together every day of every week, very quickly get to know each other and you very quickly develop what you bring to the table. So at those meetings, we're all pitching stories that we've collected from our beats. And then our editors are also sharing either leads for stories or full-blown, this is already a story idea, I just need you to get this interview. And then we take those things away on Tuesday. But the paper is never set, again, until Tuesday at whatever time we get the thing shipped out to the printer, because at any given time, that beautiful piece that I spent all this time on this week and I was so proud of, and I really liked the flourish in the third paragraph, it's going to get dumped for the bank robbery. It's going to be dumped for a 200-word update about the bank robbery, and my beautiful prose will go unread for another week.
But then it'll be in the week after.
If at all possible.
It's not like it's going in the
There are rare occasions where something is time-sensitive and you really just lose it because it wouldn't make sense to print the next week, and that always hurts a little bit, but for the most part, you can get something in the next
week. That's where your blog comes in.
That's where my blog comes in, yeah.
So right. Just so I get the mechanics. So Tuesdays you decide what's going to go in the paper so that Wednesday goes to print, Thursday it's delivered. But
the previous week's paper
you're going to be working on for the next week.
That's why Tuesdays are such a big day. We're not just ending one paper cycle, we're giving birth to the next.
So you're not just going off on your own and saying, I've decided I'm going to write a story about this. On a Tuesday, you're going to talk with
I'm
other
pitching
people,
those stories.
And they're going to say, yeah, good story, go with it, have it ready by next Tuesday.
That's right.
And is that decision, who makes that decision about what stories you're going to run with?
Ultimately, everything comes down to my editors. So that would be John and Sarah, and John's editor-in-chief. So he's usually making those calls. But again, the beauty of the system that we have working now is that generally at this point, I know what John is interested in me covering. And I also know that he trusts me to bring him things that are newsworthy. And so even if he doesn't see a story yet from an idea that I have, but I'm really enthusiastic about it, most of the time, he will at least commission me to write it. Now, if I bring it to him and it's boring or irrelevant or otherwise unnewsworthy, he reserves the right to reject it. But we've gotten to a pretty good place where, for the most part, even though I am absolutely pitching things to him and he's approving them, we have a pretty good rhythm going, and that goes for our other reporters
too.
So
you're pitching ideas that things that have come up to you. You want to pursue it. You're a reporter. You want to pursue this.
Mm-hmm.
But then I assume there are some times where either you don't have something or it gets rejected or whatever, and John or Sarah is going to say, this is a story we want you to cover.
Yep.
It may not be education. It may be some other thing about a restaurant getting licensed to serve liquor or something.
Absolutely.
This is what's important. You're off education this week. You're on the restaurant.
Absolutely. And I chase stories that aren't education related either. That's the beauty of it is I get assigned stories that aren't education related. And I also am given license to chase these stories. If I find a good story, no one's going to tell me because it's not my beat, or at least generally speaking. Now, I'm infringing on someone else's beat, but no one's going to tell me, oh no, you're in a hole. I mean, we're a small operation. And so I get the opportunity to write everything you can imagine, from cats and trees to elections.
We have time for one more question.
I'll let you have it.
Thank you. Are you going to do a piece? I'm just interested. The whole sexual harassment thing, as we hear from women my age, older than me, younger than me, people in their 20s and 30s, I'd be really curious to know what the female students at Pali High, how they're reacting to all of this noise and how they see it.
I love that idea.
And I was wondering if you could do a story about it. Thank you.
I can never promise stories. As all this stuff that I've
have
just
have you gotten said, any hit on that at all from your travels?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'll say that my colleague Ellie just had a great piece come out. She attended a speaker who just actually held kind of a seminar at the Palisades Library, both for parents and for young people. But really just for women and men alike, the entire community, to understand how we can make our community safer, how we can make this a conversation that we can readily have, and how we can prevent some of the situations that unfortunately, but rightfully so many people are speaking out about now. And I absolutely think that pervades the school environment as well. So,
I just think there's such a different generation.
Absolutely.
They seem to interact with boys on a completely in a completely different way than we ever did.
Sure, yeah, I would say
a good thing.
Yeah, I mean, certainly generation to generation, it's fascinating to watch the changes. And already kids in high school now are acting differently from me in high school.
Well,
so.
Yeah, you're a different generation.
Absolutely,
now.
That's right.
And I just want to follow up on one last thing. You talked about working for the Access station in college. Uh-huh. Does that still interest you, doing news reporting as a television reporter, news, radio, something like that?
Absolutely. I, as a journalist, I know not to take a great job for granted, and I do not take the post for granted, and I'm loving my time here. But absolutely, we've talked about I'm at the beginning of my career, and of course it's going to unfurl in a lot of different directions, and I would love to make a return to television again because it does bring in those elements of my performing life as well that kind of translate to
and
that.
And you're obviously a very comfortable guy speaking extemporaneously and presenting yourself in a very friendly, likable way.
It's what I do for it's what I do for a living.
And you do a good job.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Your parents must be proud of you.
I'd like to hope so.
And so are we.
Yeah,
oh, you too. See how far we've come in just this time.
God, I feel like we're old pals.
Well, let's sign off so we can get the, we're going to have the photographer from the actual post come in and take some photos of
us.
That's
right.
Hardly
wait.
All right, I have to do your makeup, Steve.
Thanks so much, Matt. It's
hey, thank
fun.
You for having me. I appreciate
Thanks, Matt.
It.
We know the joy of giving is its own reward. But who says you can't get something for yourself, too? Now when you buy Vanilla MasterCard gift cards, you can enter to win one of over 10 prizes every week for 10 weeks, including a grand prize of $10,000 in Vanilla gift cards. So get gifting and start sharing the delight for more chances to win. Go to get-gifting.com to learn more and enter for your chance to win. Cards are issued by the Bancorp Bank and MetaBank, members FDIC, pursuant to license by MasterCard International Incorporated, and may be used in the U.S. everywhere debit MasterCard is accepted. Terms and conditions apply. Cards distributed and serviced by Income Financial Services, Inc., which is licensed as a money transmitter by the New York State Department of Financial Services, and MLS ID number 912772.